the dropped nickels, the needles in haystacks. There was nothing to find. He knew that. But he felt a curious peace looking out on the endless woods and water. Like the box of mirrors in his head, the way he used to slip inside and just disappear for a while.
"No can do," Claude said.
"We'd cover more country."
"No."
"But it wouldn't be. I'd have maps."
"Maps my ass. No means no."
"I could do it anyway."
"You could."
"So why not?"
The old man sighed. "Just no." At dinner that night, Wade brought it up again. It wasn't a question of practicalities. It was something he should be doing.
The old man stared at him.
"Agreed," he said. "You're already doing it."
"Alone, I mean."
"Don't con me."
"I'm not conning."
"Either way, still no."
Wade looked over at Ruth, who shook her head, then at Pat, who rolled her shoulders in a gesture that suggested something close to ridicule. "Seriously, I'd be fine," he said. "A compass and maps, no problem. Maybe a radio."
"So?" Claude said. "And then what?"
"Just look."
"Right. End up same place as your wife."
"It's something I have to try."
Pat lifted her gaze.
"God, such chivalry. I love it. I bet Kathy would, too. I don't mean the Lone Ranger."
Claude glared across the table.
He pulled out his upper denture, dipped it in his cup of coffee, and slipped it back in.
"Whatever your personal problems, let's be real extra clear. There's this word no. It means not a chance. It means forget it."
"He's good at that," Pat said. "A good, chivalrous forgetter."
"Quiet," said Claude.
"I'm just commenting."
"Oh, yeah."
"All that gallantry," Pat said. "Hi-ho, Silver."
There was snow the next morning, which turned to heavy rain, and at noon Claude swung the boat back toward the cottage. They spent the day waiting. By mid-afternoon it was snowing again, with a hard, slanting wind, and from the cottage windows there was nothing to be seen of the dock, or the boathouse, or the lake beyond. For a couple of hours they played a listless game of Scrabble in front of the fireplace. Around 5, Wade went outside with a shovel, slowly working his way from the porch to the driveway. His thoughts were mostly on magic. He scooped up the heavy, wet snow, digging hard, his mind ticking through the mechanics of a last nifty illusion. A piece of causal transportation. It could be done, like those two crazy snakes in Pinkville. Curiously, as he worked out the details, Wade found himself experiencing a new sympathy for his father. This was how it was. You go about your business. You carry the burdens. Entomb yourself in silence. Conceal demon history from all others, and most times from yourself. Nothing theatrical. Shovel snow. Diddle at politics or run a jewelry store. Seek periodic forgetfulness. Betray the present with every breath drawn from the bubble of a rotted past. And then one day you discover a length of clothesline. You amaze yourself. You pull over a garbage can and hop aboard and hook yourself up to forever. No notes, no diagrams. You don't explain a thing. Which was the art of it? His father's art. Kathy's art. That magnificent giving over to pure and absolute mystery. It was the difference, he thought, between evil and a bad childhood. To know is to be disappointed. To understand is to be betrayed. All the petty hows and whys, the unseemly motives, the abscesses of character, the sordid little ugliness of self and history, these were the gimmicks you kept under wraps to the end. Better to leave your audience wailing in the dark, shaking their fists, some crying, "How?" others, "Why?" When dusk had come, Wade put his shovel aside and moved down the slope to the dock. The snow had let up. He didn't think about it. Quickly, he stripped naked and filled his lungs and dove to the bottom where Kathy was. To his bemusement, there was no chill, or else the chill was lost on him. He did not open his eyes. He located a piling at the point where it had been driven into the gravel, took hold and propelled himself beneath the dock, belly down, feeling only the discomfort of his own vague intentions. There was the quality of a rehearsal, like a test run. Maybe his father had once done things very much like this in the musty stillness of the garage, emboldening himself, examining the rafters with an eye for levitation. For a few moments, Wade considered opening his eyes just to know, but in the dark it wouldn't have mattered. He came to the surface and went down again. The possibilities were finite. She was there, or she wasn't. And if she wasn't, she was elsewhere. And even that didn't matter. Guilt had no such solution. It was false-bottomed. It was the trap door he'd been performing on all these years, the love he'd withheld, the poisons he'd kept inside. For his entire life, it seemed, there had been the terror of discovery. A fat little kid doing magic in front of a stand-up mirror. "Hey, kiddo, that's a good one," his father could have said. But for reasons unknown, reasons mysterious, the words never got spoken. He had wanted to be loved. And to be loved, he had practiced deception. He had hidden the bad things. He had tricked up his own life, only for love, only to be loved. The cold pressed into his ribcage. He could taste the lake. Eyes closed deep, he glided by feel along the water-polished pilings beneath the dock. He could sense her presence. Yes, he could. The touch of her flesh, her wide open eyes, her bare feet, her empty womb, her hair like wet weeds. Amazing, he thought, what love could do. He let out the last of his air, pushed to the surface, hoisted himself onto the dock, dressed quickly and trotted through the snow to the cottage. Shortly after 8, Art Lux called. He spoke first to Pat, then to Wade. The man's dairy farmer voice rode the scales of apology as he explained that the official search was being discontinued. Purely a formality, he said. Paperwork to file, red tape, and so on. Wade shifted the receiver to his other hand. He glanced over at Pat, who was crying. "Give it up?" he said. "Just like that?"
"Not exactly. It sounds..." "No, sir, we're not quitting. Still places to look, if you know what I mean."
"I don't," Wade said.
"Sir?"
"I don't know." Lux paused.
"Well, places."
There was a sound on the line that Wade took to be someone else's voice. After a second, Lux asked if he could speak with Claude. Wade handed the phone over. He stood awkwardly at the center of the kitchen, off balance, wondering if there was something he should be doing or saying, some overlooked gesture. Tears, maybe, except he was tired of pretending. He went to the refrigerator, took out a tray of ice cubes, built himself a vodka tonic. Pat's low crying irritated him. It seemed profoundly wrong. When all was lost, he thought, the thing to do was grab a hammer or mix a drink. Like father, like son. In a few minutes, Claude hung up and motioned at Wade. They went out to the living room. The old man looked very tired.
"Whole thing's ridiculous," he said. "But I guess you know what's going to happen."
"Pretty much."
"I can't say no."
"That's fine." Claude slumped on the couch, massaged the pouches under his eyes.
"Wouldn't help none anyway. Either way, they'll rip this place apart. They got this idea, you know, they figure probably she's around here somewhere. The boathouse, on the grounds."
"She's not," Wade said.
"But it doesn't matter."
"Fucking does matter. I just wish..."
The old man closed his eyes.
Watching him, Wade was struck by the notion that he had a genuine friend in the world. Unique development, he thought. Claude blinked and looked up pensively from the couch.
A situation, isn't it?
That's what it is, Wade said.
No win, no tie. They don't find anything, you're still a sinner. After what happened with the election, all the garbage that leaked out.
The old man looked at Wade's drink.
You mind?
Wade gave him the glass. They were quiet for a time, passing the drink. Then Claude reached out and put a hand on Wade's knee.
I don't want to be sappy. She was all you had, right?
Yes.
And you didn't do zilch.
I did things. Not that.
Right.
Claude took his hand away.
And there ain't nothing else. You know, nothing else you can say?
There never was.
Naturally. That's what I keep telling people. Guy yells wolf, he gets stuck with the mistake, can't say a goddamn thing to change anybody's mind.
The old man sighed and finished off the drink.
Same with how you've been acting, right? No use blubbering. Wouldn't help a bit.
Maybe that's it, Wade said. You get tired of the politics.
Claude nodded. Which is how I'd handle it. The same. Let the bastards think what they want.
The old man got up and went to the kitchen and came back with two tall drinks. He switched on a lamp, but even so the cottage had the feel of a funeral home. They didn't speak. Outside in the woods a pair of owls were having their own conversation. Claude finally sighed.
Well, anyhow, I guess you won't want to be here for the festivities when they tear things up. There's the car. You could head back to the cities. Just sit tight. Right now, you're still free to go.
You know I can't do that.
I'll want a boat, Claude.
Sure you will.
Gasoline?
A full tank?
Not for me. We've been all through that. I don't need two good clients out there.
And the chart book?
I'm sorry.
I'll find a way.
Yeah, no doubt.
Claude looked up with his tired old crow eyes. It occurred to Wade that the man was not well.
No lie, Senator. I am sorry. Conscience and all that. Get to be my age. A guy needs his sleep at night.
He took out a red hanky and ran it across his forehead.
You understand?
Yes, of course. How much time do I have?
Day after tomorrow. Or the day after that. Lux has got the state police coming up. Criminal investigator types. Couple sniffer dogs.
Lovely, Wade said.
It had to happen.
Sure it did. Wade winked. Senator. I liked that.
By morning the snow had mostly melted, and the temperature was up in the high 40s. They spent the day out on the lake, searching north and northeast of Magnuson's Island. There were no other boats out. No aircraft, no motion at all. On occasion the sun appeared low over the horizon, yet even then the sky had a dull grayish cast that seemed to take its color from their mood. The tensions were beyond coping. No one bothered. Pat sat like a rock at the rear of the boat. She wouldn't look at him, or even through him. When necessary, she addressed her remarks to the lake. Wade preferred it that way. His own thoughts had mellowed. Certain burdens had already been put down. Others soon would be. He regarded the lake without terror. One thing he'd learned, the world had its own sneaky little tricks. Over the past days, despite everything, the lost election had come to seem almost a windfall. He felt lighter inside, nothing left to hide. Tuan Yen was still there, of course, and always would be. But the horror now was outside him, ugly and pitiful and public. No less evil, he thought, but at least the demands of secrecy were gone, which was another of nature's sly tricks. Once you're found out, you don't tremble at being found out. The trap door drops open. All you can do is fall gracefully, and far, and deep.
And soon other issues would be settled. Sanity, for instance. Courage for another. Love for a last. He gazed out at a pair of small islands passing by. For the first time in many years, maybe ever, he felt a sense of sureness about himself. At 3 o'clock, Claude pulled up to the docks in Angle Inlet to take on fuel. They walked up to Pearson's Texaco station, where Wade excused himself, and crossed the street. In the mini-mart, he purchased 2 loaves of bread, sandwich meats, 1/5 of vodka, a large tourist map, 3 cans of Sterno, and a small plastic compass endorsed by the Boy Scouts of America. The plump girl behind the counter gave him a long look as he paid. Myra something. Albino blood. Very nosy. The idea came to him that he should bare his teeth, but instead he wished her a pleasant day and walked out with the goods. His dreams that night, as he would remember them, were situated inside a chrome computer. He'd crawled in through a manhole. He was demanding a recount. Arithmetic! He was yelling. But the computer made a coughing noise that turned into a deep, mocking purr. All the wires were tangled. The circuitry was composed of electric eels, and there were colorful fish and liquid poisons and numerous examples of evil. When he awoke, the hour was approaching dawn. He dressed in clean corduroys, cotton socks, a white flannel shirt, a finely woven cashmere sweater that Kathy had presented to him on a Christmas Eve not so long ago. He rolled up a pair of blankets. An old sheet, too. There were traces of early light as he moved down the hallway to the kitchen. It was no great surprise to find the boat key lying squarely at the center of the formica table. Alongside was an envelope. He pocketed these items, put on a pair of rubber boots, picked up his provisions, and walked down the slope to the dock. He felt no special sentiment. A misled life, nothing else. Kath, oh Kath, he thought. It was impossible to conceive of her as dead, simply lost among the missing. In the frail dark, he stepped into the Chriscraft and secured his things. A little dazed, a little dreamy. After all the lies, a couple of minor truths had now appeared. Or whatever the certainty was that held his heart when he thought, Kath, my Kath. He untied the mooring ropes. He started up the engine, felt the boat rise and take to the water. 100 yards out, he looked back at the small yellow cottage on the slope above the lake. Love, he thought, which was one truth. You couldn't lose it even if you tried. He took out his new compass and swung the boat north. Later, when he looked back, the yellow cabin was gone. But even then, in his mind's eye, he could see a man and a woman lying quietly on a porch in the dense night fog, wrapped in blankets, holding each other, pretending things were not so bad. He could hear their voices as they took turns thinking up names for the children they wanted. Funny names, sometimes, so they could laugh. And he could hear them planning the furnishings for their new house, the fine rugs they would buy, the antique brass lamps, the exact colors of the wallpaper, all the details. Verona, Kathy said. And then they talked about Verona, the things they would see and do, and soon the fog was all around them and inside them, and they were swallowed up and gone. Not a footprint, not a single clue, all woods and water. A place where 1 + 1 always came to 0. Chapter 24. Hypothesis. Or maybe she'd left him long ago, in the summer of 1983, when she flew off to meet Harmon in Boston. In the years that followed, she had mostly kept the secret inside, where it was like a weight that had to be carried through her life and marriage. And maybe one day it became too much for her. Not just the affair, everything. A decayed marriage, deferred dreams, withheld intimacies. For all these years, even before the fling with Harmon, there had been an ever-widening distance between the life she wanted and the life she had. Suicide? Impossible to know. Certainly the pressures were enormous. She was on Valium and Restoril. The ruins were everywhere. her husband, the election, the unborn child in her heart. So maybe she'd planned it, or half-planned it, taking the boat out and aiming it straight north, and losing herself forever in Lake of the Woods. At some point, on a rocky beach, perhaps, in the dark, she might have found herself cataloging the events that had conspired to bring her here. The disappointments, the slow strangulation by politics, how the affair with Harmon had started almost by accident, a chance meeting, a few casual letters, and how after 4 months it had ended the same way, without choice or volition, as if she were strapped into the back seat of her own life. And what had changed? Still out of control, still at the whim of a world that seemed aligned against her. The sadness was crushing. How things were. How things could have been. Maybe she had already swallowed the medications. Or maybe she did it now, with plenty of lake water. Then sat down again and let her thoughts skip back to the Boston airport. Harmon meeting her there. The drive north along the coast of Maine to a resort called Loon Point, where they'd spent 4 days and 3 nights, and where on the morning of the 4th day after breakfast she had informed him that it was over. A mistake, she'd said. She loved her husband. She remembered Harmon's round white face, a dentist's face, concentrating. Well, he'd said. Nothing else. And now it was all a mystery. She couldn't recall the color of the man's eyes, or how she had come to care about him, or what had happened to wake her up. The whole affair struck her as something quaint and foreign. She remembered how they'd gone dancing one night at Loon Point, how adventurous it had seemed, how the music and starlight and danger had stirred her to feel close to him, almost giddy with pleasure, but how in a curious way it was not really Harmon in her arms, it was the idea of happiness, the possibility, the temptation, a slow, tantalizing waltz with some handsome future. For a few minutes, maybe, Kathy looked out across the lake and allowed herself to cry. Or maybe the drugs were at work, a nice dark calm tugging her down. The flight back to Minneapolis was a blur now, a mostly empty jet, a couple of martinis. It had been late afternoon when she carried her suitcase into the apartment and put it down, and stood listening to the quiet. She remembered pouring herself a glass of wine. She remembered filling the bathtub, slipping in, soaking there for a long while. At 6 o'clock, she'd moved out to the kitchen to start supper. A half hour later, when John walked in, she'd fixed her eyes elsewhere, adjusting the heat on her electric skillet, using a spatula to drop on 3 pork chops. John had come up behind her. "The Globetrotter," he'd said, and kissed her neck, his fingers briefly squeezing the inch or two of loose flesh at her waist. It was a habit she disliked. It made her feel fat. But she remembered a quick rush of gratitude. Immediately, by the pressure of his fingers, she knew he had no inkling. They'd eaten supper in front of the TV. During the commercials, in a voice she recognized as politely forced, he'd asked a few vague questions about the trip. He was interested in the airline food, the weather, the high school friend she'd been visiting. She had kept her answers short. The friend was a bore, the weather hot, the food poisonous. John had nodded at the TV. It was all too easy. At one point, she'd apologized to him about the foul-up. "Foul-up?" he'd said. "You know, the flight." "No kidding?" She'd glanced over at him. "I was due in tomorrow. I explained how..." "You didn't get the message?"
"Whoops," he'd said, and grinned at her. "Never checked the machine."
She remembered staring at her plate. The pork chops had left a fleshy, rancid taste on her tongue. Stupidly, without calculation, she was seized by the need to retaliate. What she should have done, she thought, was to call in a message describing the dance floor at Loon Point, the cozy hotel room, the wallpaper, the bedspread, all the details. She remembered carrying her plate into the kitchen, rinsing it off, moving out to the tiny back patio, and just standing there in the leaden twilight. He would never know. Not the specifics. The secret was safe.
Yet, in the evening air, like a blank tape, there was the hum of a terrifying question. Does any of it really matter? Which then deepened into the sound of an imperfect, infinitely approximate answer. Who knows? She remembered opening her robe to the humid night air. There was a huge and desperate wanting in her heart, wanting without object, pure wanting. Later, John had come out.
"Hey, gorgeous," he'd said, and stood beside her in the heavy twilight. "So you had fun? A good trip?"
She remembered pulling her robe tight, turning toward him without contrition or clues. "Fine," she'd said. Maybe in the end she blamed herself, not for the affair so much, but for the waning of energy, the slow year-by-year fatigue that had finally worn her down. She had stopped trying. She had given up on squirt guns. She had forfeited her dreams, and the fling with Harmon was just an emblem of all the unhappiness in her life. Maybe there were secret forces she could not tolerate. Maybe memory, maybe drugs. Maybe in Lake of the Woods, where all is repetition, she whispered, "Why?" And then closed her eyes and sank into the sound of the endless answer, "Who knows? Who ever knows?"
Chapter 25. Evidence.
"Reminds me of those three monkeys. The man didn't hear nothing, didn't smell nothing, didn't see nothing. He sure as shit did something."
Vincent R. Vinnie Pearson.
"Ridiculous. Mr. Wade loved his wife. Anybody could see that. Just like Claude and me."
Ruth Rasmussen.
"All I know is they come into the mini-mart awful unhappy. They sat there unhappy. They left unhappy. That's all I know."
Myra Shaw, waitress.
"I don't make guesses."
Arthur J. Lux, sheriff, Lake of the Woods County.
"I had prayed to God that this thing was fiction."
Colonel William V. Wilson, U.S. Army investigator.
"Exhibit 10, photographs 12 of victims at Tuan Yen. Date, 16 March 1968. Photographer, Ronald Haberl."
The attitude of all the men, the majority I would say, was a revengeful attitude. Gregory T. Olson, 1st Platoon, Charlie Company.
"People were talking about killing everything that moved. Everyone knew what we were going to do."
Robert W. Pendleton, 3rd Platoon, Charlie Company.
"Vice never sees its own ugliness. If it did, it would be frightened by its own image. Shakespeare's Iago, who behaves in a way that's true to his nature, sounds false because he is forced by our dramatic conventions to unmask himself, to himself be the one to lay bare the secrets of his complex and crooked heart. In reality, man seldom tramples his conscience underfoot so casually."
George Sand, Indiana.
"We were all psyched up because we wanted revenge for some of our fallen comrades that had been killed prior to this operation in the general area of Pinkville."
Alan J. Boyce, 1st Platoon, Charlie Company.
"We were breathing flies when it was over. They crawled up into our noses."
Richard Thinbill.
"We must act with vindictive earnestness against the Sioux, even to their extermination, men, women, and children."
General William Tecumseh Sherman.
"Exterminate the whole fraternity of Redskins."
Nebraska City Press.
"That day in My Lai, I was personally responsible for killing about 25 people. Personally. Men, women. From shooting them to cutting their throats, scalping them to cutting off their hands and cutting out their tongues. I did it."
Varnado Simpson, 2nd Platoon, Charlie Company.
"No prisoners were being taken, and no one was allowed to escape if escape could be prevented. A child of about 3 years, perfectly naked, was toddling along over the trail where the Indians had fled. A soldier saw it, fired at about 75 yards distance, and missed it. Another dismounted and said, "Let me try the little. I can hit him." He missed two, but a third dismounted with a similar remark, and at his shot the child fell. The Indians lost 300, all killed, of whom about one half were warriors, and the remainder women and children. J.P. Dunn, Jr., Massacre of the Mountains. Footnote. J.P. Dunn, Jr., Massacres of the Mountains. New York, Archer House, 1886, pages 343 to 345. This passage describes in part the Battle of Sand Creek, an attack by two regiments of Colorado militia on a Cheyenne village in present-day Oklahoma on November 29, 1864. End of note. Kathy tried, I'll say that, way too hard. Personally, I guess I never gave him much of a chance. Patricia S. Hood. She wanted to travel, see the world. I remember she used to talk about Verona all the time, but I don't think she knew much about it except for Romeo and Juliet. Bethany Key, Associate Admissions Director, University of Minnesota. You get involved, try to help, put your own needs aside. Then it's 12 years later, and you don't know how to have fun anymore. You're exhausted, pissed off, anxious, profoundly depressed, guilty because you can't fix it. As a matter of fact, overfunctioning to hide your partner's problems from others is defined as normal in this society. Patience H. C. Mason, Recovering from the War. It stays with me, even after all these years. I guess it probably haunted John, too, except he tried to do something about it. Erase it, you know? Literally. Richard Thinbill. They did not fight us like a regular army, only like savages, behind trees and stone walls, and out of the woods and houses. The colonists are as bad as the Indians for scalping and cutting the dead men's ears and noses off. Anonymous British Infantryman, 1775. After the battles at Lexington and Concord. When we first started losing members of the company, it was mostly through booby traps and snipers. You didn't trust anybody. In the end, anybody that was still in the country was the enemy. Fred Widmer, member of Charlie Company. Our British troops were so enraged at suffering from an unseen enemy that they forced open many of the houses and put to death all those found in them. Lieutenant Frederick Mackenzie, 1775, after the battles at Lexington and Concord. Question. You killed men, women, and children? Answer. Yes. You were ordered to do so? Yes. Why did you carry out that order? I was ordered to, and I was emotionally upset, and we were supposed to get satisfaction from this village for the men we'd lost. They was all VC and VC sympathizers, and I still believe they was all Viet Cong and Viet Cong sympathizers. Paul Meadlow, Court-Martial Testimony. On the road, in our route home, we found every house full of people and the fences lined as before. Every house from which they fired was immediately forced, and every soul in them put to death. Horrible carnage. Oh, Englishmen! To what depth of brutal degeneracy are ye fallen? Anonymous British Officer, 1775, after the battles at Lexington and Concord. Question. This sorcerer, you can't recall his name? Answer. Not right at this exact minute. And he giggled? That was afterward. He was upset. Richard Thinbill, Court-Martial Testimony. I have encouraged the troops to capture and root out the Apache by every means, and to hunt them as they would wild animals. This they have done with unrelenting vigor. Since my last report, over 200 have been killed. General Edward O. Ord. Kathy was no angel. That dentist. I shouldn't say his name. Anyway, I don't think there are any angels. I guess it hurt him pretty bad. John, I mean. Patricia S. Hood. The British troops committed every wanton wickedness that a brutal revenge could stimulate. Anonymous Observer, 1775,
after the battles at Lexington and Concord. My conscience seems to become little by little sooted. If I can soon get out of this war and back on the soil where the clean earth will wash away these stains. J. Glenn Gray, The Warriors. Homeless My Lai vet killed in booze fight. Pittsburgh. A Vietnam veteran who participated in the My Lai massacre and later became a homeless alcoholic who lived under a bridge was shot to death in an argument over a bottle of vodka. Police have charged a female drinking companion with shooting Robert W. Tsuvas once in the head in the altercation earlier this month. He had problems with Vietnam over and over. He didn't talk about it much, said his father, William Tsuvas. The army charged Tsuvas with premeditated murder of two unidentified Vietnamese children with a machine gun. But he testified the children were bleeding, mutilated, and dying, and he killed them to put them out of their misery. Lieutenant William Calley was the only one convicted of the My Lai killings. Boston Herald. 20 years later, when you look back at things that happened, things that transpired, things you did, you say, why? Why did I do that? That is not me. Something happened to me. Fred Widmer, member of Charlie Company. Exhibit 8, John Wade's Box of Tricks, partial list. Invisible ink, coin pull, servant, the floating glass vase, book, a magi's gift, book, the Piers Commission report. After his father died, he spent a lot of time down here at the store. I think probably he had a little crush on me, the way he called me Carrot Lady, like I was something special. Sandra Cara, Cara's Studio of Magic. I guess you could say John ran out of magic. Once the media jumped on him, it was all over. He knew that. Those ugly headlines, they would have knocked St. Peter out of politics. Minnesota isn't the kind of place where you say you're sorry and expect people to forget. Lots of Lutherans here. Anthony L. Tony Carbo. Always John. You're driving me nuts. I mean, wake up. I get tired of saying it. Kathy had troubles, too. Her own history, her own damn life. Patricia S. Hood. A lot of political wives are unhappy here in Washington. They have no life of their own and wonder, who am I? Am I just somebody's wife? Or is there something more? Arvon Fraser, wife of former Congressman Don Fraser. Pat Nixon fooled everybody who did not know her intimately, never letting on that most of the time she hated the whole thing. Politics was anathema to Pat. She made this luminously clear to persons she knew and trusted. Lester David, the Lonely Lady of San Clemente. After his resignation, Nixon was gripped by deep melancholia. He would sit for hours in his study, unable or unwilling to move, eating little. He suffered from severe insomnia. There is reason to speculate that if it were not for Pat Nixon's constant attention and encouragement during the low points in his life, from August until past Thanksgiving, Richard Nixon might have gone over the brink into total mental breakdown. He had come close. He admits that he had been in the depths. Lester David, The Lonely Lady of San Clemente. Think about Waterloo. Think how Napoleon felt. Life's over. You're a dead man. Anthony L. Tony Carbo. Much of the shame that therapists treat is repressed, defended against, unfelt. But the potential to feel the shame is nevertheless there, often so heightened that it has become like a deformed body part that we organize our lives to keep ourselves and others from seeing. Robert Caron, Shame. It is a harsh question, yet is it possible that Nixon lied to his wife and to his family, as well as to the country, about the full scope of his involvement in the cover-up of the Watergate affair? Lester David, The Lonely Lady of San Clemente. That sorcerer crap. Anybody makes up names for himself, you have to wonder. Like he didn't even know who the hell he was. Vincent R. Vinnie Pearson. John had all kinds of extra names.
I remember his father used to call him Little Merlin, or Little Houdini, and that Jiggling John one. Maybe he got used to it. Maybe he felt... Maybe it sort of helped to call him sorcerer. I hope so. Eleanor K. Wade. By taking a new name, an unfinished person may hope to enter into more dynamic, but not necessarily more intimate, transactions, both with the world outside and with his or her true soul, the naked self. Justin Kaplan, The Naked Self and Other Problems. B. Travin's longing to vanish in death without a trace and to return to the elements from which he came echoes his lifelong hunger for anonymity, for disappearing without a name, or with a fictitious name, so that his true identity would be lost forever. The life of a pseudonym is the life of a dead man, of one who does not exist. Carl S. Guthke, B. Travin. Give it up. Totally hopeless. Nobody will ever know. Patricia S. Hood. I've said everything I can think of. Can't we just stop now? I'm an old lady. Why keep asking me these things? Eleanor K. Wade. Footnote. Why do we care about Lizzie Borden, or Judge Crater, or Lee Harvey Oswald, or the Little Bighorn? Mystery. Because of all that cannot be known. And what if we did know? What if it were proved, absolutely and purely, that Lizzie Borden took an axe, that Oswald acted alone, that Judge Crater fell into Sicilian hands? Nothing more would beckon. Nothing would tantalize. The thing about Custer is this. No survivors. Hence, eternal doubt, which both frustrates and fascinates. It's a standoff. The human desire for certainty collides with our love of enigma. And so I lose sleep over mute facts and frayed ends and missing witnesses. God knows I've tried. Reams of data, miles of magnetic tape. But none of it satisfies even my own primitive appetite for answers. So I toss and turn. I eat pints of ice cream at 2 a.m. Would it help to announce the problem early on? To plead for understanding? To argue that solutions only demean the grandeur of human ignorance? To point out that absolute knowledge is absolute closure? To issue a reminder that death itself dissolves into uncertainty, and that out of such uncertainty arise great temples and tales of salvation? I prowl and smoke cigarettes. I review my notes. The truth is at once simple and baffling. John Wade was a pro. He did his magic, then walked away. Everything else is conjecture. No answers, yet mystery itself carries me on. Chapter 26. The Nature of the Dark. They were young, all of them. Callie was 24, Tasuvis was 19, Thinbill was 18, Sorcerer was 23, Conti was 21. Young and scared, and almost always lost. The war was a maze. In the months after Tuan Yin, they wandered here and there, no aim or direction, searching veals and setting up ambushes and taking casualties and doing what they had to do because nothing else could be done. The days were difficult. The nights were impossible. At dusk, after their holes were dug, they would sit in small groups and look out across the paddies, and wait for darkness to settle in around them. The dark was their shame. It was also their future. They tried not to talk about it, but sometimes they couldn't help themselves. Thinbill talked about the flies. Tasuvis talked about the smell. Their voices would seem to flow away for a time, and then return to them from somewhere beyond the swaying fields of rice. It was an echo, partly. But inside the echo were sounds not quite their own, a kind of threnody, a weeping, something melodic and sad. They would sometimes stop to listen, but the sound was never there when listened for. It mixed with the night. There were stirrings all around them, things seen, things not seen, which was in the nature of the dark.
Charlie Company never returned to Tuan Yin. There were rumors of an investigation, nervous jokes and nervous laughter, but in the end, nothing came of it. The war went on. More villages and patrols, and random terror. On occasion, late at night, Sorcerer would find himself sliding back into wickedness, trapped at the bottom of a bubbling ditch. But over time, the whole incident took on a dreamlike quality, only half remembered, half believed. He tried to lose himself in the war. He took uncommon risks, performed unlikely deeds. He was wounded twice, once badly, but in a peculiar way, the pain was all that kept body and soul together. In late November of 1968, he extended his tour for an extra year. "It's a personal decision," he wrote Kathy. "Maybe someday I'll be able to explain it. Right now, I can't leave this place." On ambush sometimes, in the paddies outside a sleeping village, Sorcerer would crouch low and watch the moon, and listen to the many voices of the dark, the ghosts and gremlins, his father, all the late-night visitors. The trees talked, the bamboo and the rocks. He heard people pleading for their lives. He heard things breathing, things not breathing. It was entirely in his head, like midnight telepathy, but now and then he'd look up to see a procession of corpses bearing lighted candles through the dark, women and children, P.F.C. Weatherby, an old man with bony shins and a small wooden hoe. "Go away," he'd murmur. And sometimes they would. Other times, though, he would have to call in artillery. He would fire up the jungles. He would make the rivers burn. 2 months before his tour was up, Sorcerer found a desk job in the battalion adjutant's office. It was easy duty, all paperwork, no humping, a tin roof over his head. The real war had ended. The trick now was to devise a future for himself. He thought about it for several weeks, weighing the possibilities. Late one evening, he locked himself in the office, took out the battalion muster roll, hesitated briefly, and then slipped it into his typewriter. After 10 minutes, he smiled. Not foolproof, but it could be done. He went to the files and dug out a thick folder of morning reports for Charlie Company. Over the next 2 hours, he made the necessary changes, mostly retyping, some scissors work, removing his name from each document, and carefully tidying up the numbers. In a way, it helped ease the guilt. A nice, buoyant feeling. At higher levels, he reasoned, other such documents were being redrafted, other such facts neatly doctored. Around midnight, he began the more difficult task of reassigning himself to Alpha Company. He went back to the day of his arrival in country, doing the math in reverse, adding his name to the muster rolls, promoting himself, awarding the appropriate medals on the appropriate dates. The illusion, he realized, would not be perfect. None ever was. But still, it seemed a nifty piece of work, logical and smooth. Among the men in Charlie Company, he was known only as Sorcerer. Very few had ever heard his real name. Fewer still would recall it. And over time, he trusted, memory itself would be erased. He completed his paperwork just before dawn on November 6, 1969. A week later, he rotated back to the States. At the airport in Seattle, he put in a long-distance call to Kathy, then chuckled and hung up on the second ring. The flight to Minneapolis was lost time. Jet lag, maybe, but something else, too. He felt dangerous. In the skies over North Dakota, he went back into the lavatory, where he took off his uniform and put on a sweater and slacks, quietly appraising himself in the mirror. After a moment, he winked. "Hey, Sorcerer," he said. "How's tricks?" Chapter 27 Hypothesis. Maybe twice that night, John Wade woke up sweating. The first time, near midnight, he would have turned and coiled up against Kathy, brain sick, a little feverish, his thoughts wired to the nighttime hum of lake and woods. Later, he kicked back the sheets and whispered,
kill Jesus.
Quietly then he swung out of bed and moved down the hallway to the kitchen and ran water into an old iron tea kettle and put it on the stove to boil. As he waited, naked maybe, watching the ceiling, he would have felt the full crush of defeat, the horror and humiliation, the end of everything he'd ever wanted for himself. It was more than a lost election. It was disgrace. The secret was out and he was pinwheeling freestyle through the void. No pity in the world, all arithmetic, a clean, tidy sweep. St. Paul had been lost early. Duluth was lost 4-1. The unions were lost, and the German Catholics, and the rank-and-file nobodies. A winner, he thought, until he became a loser. That quick. The tea kettle made a brisk whistling sound, but he could not bring himself to move. Ambush politics. He could see it happening exactly as it happened. Front-page photographs of dead human beings in awkward poses, names and dates, eyewitness testimony. He could still see Kathy's face turning toward him on the morning when it all came undone. Now she knew. She would always know. The horror was partly Tuan Yin, partly secrecy itself, the silence and betrayal. Her expression was empty. Not shocked, just dark and vacant. 20 years of love dissolving into the certainty that nothing at all was certain. He felt electricity in his blood. Maybe then, when the water was at full boil, he pushed himself up and went to the stove. Maybe he used a towel to pick up the iron tea kettle. Stupidly, he was smiling, but the smile was meaningless. He would not remember it. He would remember only the steam and the heat and the electricity in his fists and forearms. He carried the tea kettle out to the living room and switched on a lamp and poured the boiling water over a big flowering geranium near the fireplace. "Jesus, Jesus," he was saying. There was a tropical stink. "Well now," he said, and nodded pleasantly. He heard himself chuckle. "Oh my," he said. He moved to the far end of the living room and boiled a small young spider plant. It wasn't rage, it was necessity. He emptied the tea kettle on a dwarf cactus and a philodendron and a caladium and several others. Then he returned to the kitchen. He refilled the tea kettle, watched the water come to a boil, smiled and squared his shoulders and moved down the hallway to their bedroom. A prickly heat pressed against his face. The tea kettle made hissing sounds in the night. He felt himself glide away. Some time went by, which he would not remember. Then later he found himself crouched at the side of the bed. He was rocking on his heels, watching Kathy sleep. Amazing, he thought, because he loved her. Because he couldn't stop the tea kettle from tipping itself forward. Kathy's face shifted on the pillow. Her eyelids snapped open. She looked up at him, puzzled, almost smiling, as if some magnificent new question were forming. Puffs of steam rose from the sockets of her eyes. The veins at her throat stiffened. She jerked sideways. There were noises in the night, screechings, his own name perhaps. But then the steam was in her throat. She coiled and uncoiled and coiled up again. Unreal, John decided. A dank odor filled the room. A fleshy, scalding smell, and Kathy's knuckles were doing a strange trick on the headboard, a quick rapping, then clenching up, then rapping again like a transmission in code. Bits of fat bubbled at her cheeks. He would remember thinking how impossible it was. He would remember the heat, the voltage in his arms and wrists. Why, he thought, but he didn't know. All he knew was fury. The blankets were wet. Her teeth were clicking. She twisted away, pushing with her elbows, sliding off toward the foot of the bed. A purpley stain spilled out across her neck and shoulders. Her face seemed to fold up. Why? He kept thinking. Except there were no answers and never would be. Maybe sunlight.
Maybe the absence of sunlight. Maybe electricity. Maybe a vanishing act. Maybe a pair of snakes swallowing each other along a trail in Pinkville. Maybe his father. Maybe secrecy. Maybe humiliation and loss. Maybe madness. Maybe evil. He was aware of voices in the dark, women and children, slaughterhouse sounds, but the voices were not part of what he would remember. He would remember darkness. The skin at her forehead blistered up, peeling off in long, ragged strips. Her lips were purplish blue. She jerked once and shuddered and curled up and hugged herself and lay still. She looked cold. There was a faint trembling at her fingers. Maybe he kissed her. Maybe he wrapped her in a sheet. Maybe some black time went by before he carried her down the slope to the dock, gliding, full of love, laying her down, and then moving to the boathouse and opening up the double doors. "Kath, my Kath," he would have whispered. He would have dragged the boat out into shallow water, letting it fishtail there while he went back for the engine. The fog had lifted. There was a moon and many stars. For a few seconds he was aware of certain sounds in the dark, the nighttime murmur of lake and woods, his own breathing as he locked in the engine and waded back to the boathouse for the oars and gas can and life vest. He was sorcerer now. He was inside the mirrors. He would have used the oars to pull over to the dock, tying up there, feeling the waves beneath him and lifting her up and thinking, "Kath, my Kath," placing her in the boat, and then returning to the cottage for her sneakers and jeans and white cotton sweater. Maybe he whispered magic words. Maybe he felt something beyond the glide. Remorse, perhaps, or grief. But there were no certainties now, no facts. And like a sleepwalker, he would have made his way back to the boat and started the engine, and turned out into the big silent lake. He did not go far, maybe 200 yards. In the dark, the boat shifting beneath him, he caused her sneakers to vanish in deep water, then her jeans and sweater. He weighted her with polished gray rocks from the slope below the cottage. "Kath, Kath," he must have said, and maybe other things. And then dispatched her to the bottom. Later, he would have eased himself into the lake. He would have tipped the boat and held it firm against the waves and let it fill and sink away from him. Maybe he joined her for a while. Maybe he didn't. At one point, he felt an underwater rush in his ears. At another point, he found himself alone on the dock, cold and naked, watching the stars. And then later still he woke up in bed. A soft pinkish light played against the curtains. For a few seconds he studied the effects of dawn, the pale ripplings and gleamings. He reached out for Kathy, who wasn't there, then hugged his pillow and returned to the bottoms. Chapter 28. How he went away. 3 miles out in open lake, Wade turned straight north. Dawn came up thin and cold. By 7 in the morning he was well beyond Buckeat Island, moving at 15 knots, nothing ahead but the wilds. On occasion he found himself scanning the lake, throttling down as he passed bleak islands of rock and pine. Hopeless, he realized. Kathy was not to be found. It was finished, obviously. And he had to take consolation in the fine line between biology and spirit. Around mid-morning he crossed over into Canadian waters and continued north through a chain of thickly wooded islands. The Chris craft bounced along nicely, an expensive wheel-steered vessel, trim and fast. At moderate speeds, Wade estimated, the topped-off tanks gave him a 200-mile cruising range. The emergency gas cans might tack on another 50, which was sufficient. Emergencies belonged to an earlier period. Now it was down to essentials. He leaned back, calm and relaxed,
letting his thoughts mix with the overall flow of things, the sweeps of timber, the waves and water. Not so bad. Not at all. The day had